Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
These discussions with paramilitaries were at play with death.
Remarkable personal stories from around the world.
They don't speak with words, they speak with guns.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 1st of May, these are our main stories. Violence has erupted at a university in Los Angeles between pro-Palestinian protesters and a rival group supporting Israel. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has met Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel after accusing Hamas of being the only remaining obstacle to a ceasefire in Gaza. And we'll hear from an Iraqi man whose young daughter died last week as their family tried to reach Britain in an overcrowded boat. Also in this podcast, the lucky teenager in Australia who caught $1 million fish and...
They do the dangerous things for us. They take the hits. When you understand what they're risking personally and physically, it only deepens your appreciation for what they do.
Actor Ryan Gosling on his new film, The Fall Guy, and a growing appreciation of stuntmen. We begin in the United States.
Free Palestine!
Universities across the US have been gripped by protests as students demand a boycott of companies and individuals with ties to Israel. In a moment, we'll be hearing from New York, where overnight police arrested dozens of protesters. But first to Los Angeles and the UCLA campus. As we record this podcast, police are on the scene. Pro-Palestinian protesters have been confronted by counter-demonstrators supporting Israel. A local journalist, Sergio Olmos, spoke to the BBC's Lucy Hawkins from the scene.
Police are holding a line just outside of the encampment. They've swept the area where the counter-protesters were clashing with the Palestinian demonstrators here. For about an hour, there was no police presence. Counter-protesters were fighting with the Palestinian demonstrators. They came out at night, just after midnight. They launched fireworks into the encampment and tried to bring down the encampment, going into the wooden fence there and try to bring it down, would hit people with sticks, would throw bottles, in some cases glass bottles, and there was pepper sprays.
So, Sergio, was it a case that the police weren't there at all, or they were there and didn't interfere?
No, they didn't intervene. So I got here about 12:20 in the morning, and for about an hour, the clashes were going on. Police got here at 1:45 in the morning. They formed a line about a few hundred feet away, but then for another hour, just stood there. They did not intervene. Once they got closer, just after 2 in the morning, that's when the counter-protesters stepped away. They chanted USA, USA, and left. And there was no visible arrest on either side. But the police stood there for about an hour watching as demonstrators and counter-demonstrators were clashing in front of each other. Police did not take a attack of intervention here. They have brought their gas masks out. They do have batons, but they did not intervene in tonight's melees.
And Sergio, do we know what it is that precipitated this violence tonight? Was there a particular incident?
Well, this has been building up since Thursday. There has been the screen behind me. That's what was put on by these counter-demonstrators. They wanted to show support for Israel. They wanted to have a counter-narrative to what the Palestinian demonstrators are doing here. But there's been a lot of anger building. And so tonight, what you saw was this kind of group of mostly men come out and try to fight with them. They did come out to fight, and fight they did. And the police response was kind of to just let them go at it, either because the police did not have enough numbers or they just did not have a plan for what would happen when counter-demonstrators came, you know, with the idea of violence.
Have you managed to speak to any of those involved, any of the protesters? What sort of things have they been saying?
Well, they were shouting a lot of things. There's a lot of anger, some of it not stuff you can repeat on air, but they really came out to fight. It was a lot of younger men.
Sergio Olmos in L.A. And overnight at Columbia University in New York, police officers in riot gear climbed a ladder to enter the second floor of Hamilton Hall. This building had been taken over by pro-Palestinian protesters a day before. Windows had been smashed, and this proved to be a red line for Columbia University officials. Dozens were arrested. A reporter with CBS, Jared Hill, described the situation there this morning.
Columbia University, just from a geographical standpoint, is in the middle of New York City. It sits between two major avenues. The entrance right here behind me, which is traditionally the main entrance for the school, is locked off. Only one way in and out. Only students who live on campus, as well as any essential faculty or staff who need to be on campus, are being allowed onto the campus. There's also the question here regarding some of the consequences for any of the protesters who are on the campus, both inside the building as well as in the encampment. There is the possibility that we could see charges ranging from burglary to trespassing and disorderly conduct. And so hopefully we can get some more information on that, as well as some of the specific numbers of exactly how many people were taken into custody, how many of them were students, and again, what those consequences could be from a legal standpoint as well as from the university.
Jared Hill. With no end in sight to the war in Gaza, the U.S. Secretary of State is once again in Israel to try to push for a new 40-day truce deal. He says it's up to Hamas to agree to what Israel's put on the table. But it's not that straightforward, as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu seems determined to launch a military offensive in Rafah come what may. Our correspondent in Jerusalem is Yoland Now.
What we're seeing on this visit, he's continuing to put the onus on Hamas to accept a new deal. He's saying no more delays, no more excuses. He says that the offer that's been put by Israel, the latest one, is extraordinarily generous. And we understand it involves a 40-day ceasefire in return for some 33 vulnerable hostages still held in Gaza being released. And that would be in exchange for a much larger number of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails being freed as well. We're expecting Hamas leaders to reply within the coming day. Otherwise, while Mr. Blinken's here, we're hearing a lot of focus about aid. He's already met the Israeli president, and he said that, you know, even as we're working with a relentless determination to get the ceasefire, we've also got to focus on people in Gaza for suffering in this crossfire of Hamas's making, focusing on getting them the assistance they need, the food, medicine, water, or shelter. And he said there's been real and important progress in recent weeks, but more needs to be done. Otherwise, there's also a lot of talk going on that we've heard, particularly in the last day or so, from Israeli leaders about the International Criminal Court, with Israeli officials concerned that they could see arrest warrants accusing them of war crimes being issued in the coming days. There's been no official comment on that from the court, but Washington has already said that it doesn't support the ICC investigation here. It doesn't believe that it has jurisdiction here, but that is something that is going on in the background.
And as the diplomatic efforts continue, Mr. Blinken, as you say, is putting the onus on Hamas. But yesterday, on Tuesday, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said an assault on Rafah would go ahead regardless of whether there's an agreement. What might Mr. Blinken be saying to Israel about that?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what analysts are saying about Mr. Netanyahu's latest comments, I mean, there are those who point out that this is what he's been saying for weeks, that Israel will not stop the war before achieving all of its goals in his eyes, that it has to go into Rafah in the very south of the Gaza Strip because there are remaining Hamas battalions there. Hamas, of course, wants a permanent end to the war. This could well affect those deliberations by Hamas leaders that are going on at the moment. Washington and others have been warning against a Rafah operation because that part of the Gaza Strip now is so densely crowded, close to 1.5 million people living there, mostly displaced by the fighting elsewhere in the Strip. And there have been warnings from the likes of the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres that this could really cause an unbearable escalation, killing thousands more civilians, forcing hundreds of thousands to flee. it's not really clear whether Mr. Netanyahu does not believe in the deal, whether he's on the side of those on the far right in his coalition government who want to prioritise entering Rafah over a hostage deal at this point, or whether he's also speaking, which some say is to keep his coalition government intact, because you do have these far right ministers who have key roles making thinly veiled threats to bring down the government if there is a reckless deal that prevents a Rafah operation. So it's really not clear at the moment what effect that could have, but definitely that will be a part of his talks with Mr. Blinken.
Yolande Nell. Now, last week, our correspondent Andrew Harding was on the French coast, south of Calais, and he witnessed people boarding an overloaded boat to cross the English Channel. Five people died in that crossing, including a child, Sarah. Andrew has been speaking to her father, and we should warn listeners that they might find this report distressing.
It's just over a week since I stood on a beach here in northern France before dawn and watched a series of shocking events play out in the gloom. A group of migrants and smugglers clashing with police. There were firecrackers, smoke grenades, young men wielding iron bars. Then a huge crowd clambered into one small inflatable boat which began drifting out to sea, desperately overloaded. I could see a child briefly clinging onto a man's shoulders, then disappearing. Then I heard someone shout for help. A week on, and we now know the child was a 7-year-old girl, Sarah. And it was her father, Ahmed Al-Hashimi, who'd shouted for help as Sarah slipped from his grasp and was crushed to death beneath him in the crowded boat, one of five dead that morning. Although Sarah had never been to Iraq, her father Ahmed was born there. He left the country in 2009, saying he'd felt unsafe and that he hoped to settle in Europe. He moved to Belgium, to Sweden, to Finland, had three children. But at no point did Ahmed succeed in what he said were 14 attempts to gain asylum. So when, in February, the family received word that they might all be deported to Iraq, Ahmed settled on what he called his final option, the smuggler's boat across the channel. Now, 1 week after Sarah's death, Ahmed has agreed to return to the beach here at Wimmera to explain what happened and why he put his family in such danger.
People kept piling on. They didn't care if they were stepping on a child. People started to suffocate. Sarah said, "Help me, Dad," but I couldn't reach her. I was trapped. I'm a strong man, a builder, but I couldn't budge. I told another man to move. I screamed and hit him, but he just looked away. Finally, when the rescue boat came, they started to pull people out. Then I saw Sarah. She was in the corner. Her face was blue. She wasn't breathing.
There will be people who will say, why were you prepared to take such a risk for you and your family to try to get to England?
The sea was my last option. I applied 14 times for asylum, but they were all denied. All I wanted was for my kids to go to school. I didn't want any handouts. My wife and I can both work. I just wanted to protect them and their childhoods. What would people do if they were in my position?
Ahmed is wrestling with grief and rage and, yes, with guilt. He's due to collect Sarah's death certificate later today. Then, at some point, there'll be a funeral here in France. There will certainly be more migrants coming here, more deaths on these beautiful beaches. And more questions, too, for the French police. Could they have done more, been better prepared? Or is this a crisis that will never be resolved as long as there are families who see no other option, who are willing to risk everything, even death in the dark at sea, in a slow-motion stampede like the one that took the life of 7-year-old Sarah?
That was Andrew Harding. The American author Paul Auster, best known for his award-winning The New York Trilogy, has died at the age of 77. He'd been suffering from lung cancer. He wrote more than 30 books across his career. Many were set in Brooklyn, where he lived, and often played with themes of coincidence, chance, and fate. Here he is reading the beginning of City of Glass, the first story in the New York trilogy.
It was a wrong number that started it. The telephone ringing three times in the dead of night, and the voice on the other end asking for someone he was not. Much later, when he was able to think about the things that happened to him, he would conclude that nothing was real except chance. But that was much later. In the beginning, there was simply the event and its consequences. Whether it might have turned out differently, or whether it was all predetermined with the first word that came from the stranger's mouth, is not the question. The question is the story itself, and whether or not it means something is not for the story to tell.
Well, the arts journalist Vincent Dowd told us more about Paul Auster.
Auster was born in Newark, New Jersey, though he'll go down in literary history as a New York writer. Sometimes he wrote, as you just said, about Brooklyn, where he lived for the latter half of his life, in Park Slope, a very upmarket area indeed. He said what made him fall in love with books as a boy was encountering the adventure tales of Robert Louis Stevenson. By the time he went to study at Columbia in New York, it was the turbulent late 60s, and Columbia then, and of course, as we've been hearing today, was a focal point of tension in society at the end of the 60s. Having had enough of America for the time being, he moved to Paris, well, where else, to become a writer. In his case, he had the talent and persistence to succeed. Big success came in 1985, back in America. The New York trilogy was a playful detective story, I think you could say, influenced by writers, yes, such as Dashiell Hammett, but with a lot of philosophizing in there too. It focuses on a writer who becomes a private detective. There's a character in the novel called Paul Auster. He was asked in a BBC interview why the Paul Auster invented that Paul Auster.
I've always been interested in the fact that when you're reading a novel, who's speaking? You see War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. And then you open up the book and a voice is talking to you. Who is it? Is it Leo Tolstoy? Or is it some authorial voice that comes out of Leo Tolstoy? Well, it fascinated me to take the name that's on the cover of a book, the supposed author, and put it inside the book and to see what happens. Ironically enough, the Paul Auster character, although he resembles me, has opinions that are diametrically opposed to mine about everything. And I'm trying to make fun of myself.
And Vincent, it does seem he was more popular in Europe than in the US.
Well, I think that's true. Other books followed, such as In the Country of Last Things and Leviathan, all reviewed very widely in the US, even if the adoration, you're right, was more absolute in Europe, especially in France, where he'd lived, as we said, lots of big European awards. He's one of those writers who established a reputation quite early on in his 30s, and though that was definitely his heyday, he had many admirers right to the end. And don't forget that he directed three films, including The Inner Life of Martin Frost in 2007. Quite a few writers fantasize, frankly, about movie success. Paul Auster actually got there himself.
Vincent Dowd on the work of Paul Auster, who's died aged 77. To Australia now, where one lucky teenager has landed the catch of a lifetime. The 19-year-old from an Aboriginal family that was struggling to make ends meet has won a life-changing amount of money, thanks to a fishing trip. Jessica Wilkins reports.
Give a man a fish and you feed him for a day. Let a man go on a fishing trip and he could win $1 million. An Australian teenager caught the ultimate prize last Sunday when he snagged a rare fish. Keegan Payne was fishing in the Catherine River with his younger sister when he caught a barramundi. The 19-year-old was going to take it home to eat when his eagle-eyed sibling spotted a red tag on the fish. Measuring more than 2 feet in length, the tagged barramundi was also top prize in a fishing competition and had evaded anglers for 9 years. Now that Keegan has caught it, he has also won $1 million. That's the equivalent of $648,000. He comes from a large Aboriginal family who have been living on a tight budget. In a press conference, he said his winnings would be a big help for his family.
It's pretty hard going for us at the moment with money, but yeah, now with $1 million, we don't have to complain about it.
Keegan said he was going to take his family on holiday and buy a new boat with the money.
That report by Jessica Wilkins. Still to come.
Ponima mobilised her followers into the Hargeela army. an all-female team dedicated to protecting the greater adjutant.
Recognition for the women in India protecting a rare stork. The authorities in Georgia say 63 people were arrested and 6 officers were injured on Tuesday during protests against a new law being considered by Parliament that would affect charities, media groups or campaigners that receive any foreign funding. Those protesting say it resembles legislation used in Russia.
They say that they push it, but they don't know that us Georgian peoples would rather die than be the slaves of Russians. We will die for Georgia, and we will never be the slaves of Russians.
Our correspondent Rehan Dimitri in the capital Tbilisi told us more about the protesters.
They believe that this legislation will curtail freedoms in the country. Georgia has a vibrant civil society, non-governmental organizations and independent media. And they do a really important work in monitoring the government policies, also monitoring elections and many, many other programs. And most of these NGOs, they're funded by the EU or the United States. And therefore, this legislation, which is targeting civil society organizations and independent media, is seen by the protesters as an attack on Georgia's partners that are helping this country to move forward with their democracy. And it's also seen as an attack on the country's democracy. The reference to Russia there is because in Russia, a similar legislation was adopted in 2012, and it was expanded over the years. Now we hear almost every week, you know, new kind of critics of the government in Russia being designated as foreign agents. And therefore, Georgians think that this law is unacceptable, that it will really change the situation in the country in terms of democratic freedoms.
And what sort of reaction, if any, has there been from the European Union?
We've heard kind of condemnations, of course, this morning. Joseph Borrell, the EU foreign policy chief, he urged the government, kind of reminding Georgian authorities that this is a candidate country to join the EU. Georgia received this status back in December 2023. So Joseph Borrell called for restraint. And so far, like most of the reaction that we've heard from different European capitals and European leaders, of course, has been, first of all, urging the government not to adopt the law, saying that it is inconsistent with European values. And now, since this violence, outbreak of violence, of course, calling for restraint.
That was Rehan Dimitri in Georgia. To China next, where 24 people have died after a highway collapsed in the province of Guangdong. The images are striking, a stretch of highway with a gaping hole, the smoking remains of wrecked vehicles sitting in red mud. Our China correspondent Stephen McDonnell told us what happened.
Given by the dangerous standards of China's roads, this has been a terrible incident. A large section of highway has collapsed in the hills of Guangdong, close to Meizhou City. Even though it was the early hours of the morning, 18 vehicles were trapped. Now, many of them have fallen into this huge muddy hole. Smoke and flames have been captured on people's cameras and shared on social media. And to give an idea of how difficult it's been, local officials are saying they've sent 500 emergency workers to the site, including firefighters and mining rescue teams. Now, people might wonder why mining rescue teams. Well, of course, they're used to collapsed areas, albeit underground. It probably suits the sort of stuff they're used to working with. They've managed to get dozens of people out who've been rushed to hospital. And although we don't know exactly what's caused this, it does follow weeks of heavy driving rain in Guangdong, which has caused landslides, it's caused flooding. I mean, they even had a tornado strike Guangzhou last week, killing 5 people. And, you know, these areas, they are used to heavy rain. Like, right next to this section of highway that collapsed, there does appear to be another area which has had work done on it to try and shore it up to make sure this sort of thing doesn't happen. Nevertheless, you would be expecting to drive along a road and not have a huge hole appear in front of you, and especially to have 18 cars fall into a giant hole. It's a terrible state of affairs. And apart from that, again, the blame is going towards climate change, because although Guangzhou is used to heavy rains, as I say, it happens all the time, and even flooding in Guangdong province, the frequency and the ferocity of these things is just getting worse and worse every year. And so, you know, the calls are going out to do something about climate change here.
Stephen McDonnell in China. New research suggests footballers in the English Women's Super League are more likely to get injured at certain points in their menstrual cycle. The study found players were 6 times more likely to pick up a muscle injury in the days leading up to their period than during it. Here's our sports correspondent, Katie Gornall.
Female footballers have long suspected a link between injury risk and their periods, but little research exists in this area, or in women's sport in general. Scientists, including those from UCL and the University of Bath, are trying to change that. They tracked players from a top WSL club for 3 years in the first study of its kind. They found that they were 6 times more likely to experience a muscle injury in the premenstrual phase compared to when they were on their period. Further research is needed to explore why that might be. 26 players were monitored, but despite the relatively small sample size, the authors of the study say it should be a call to action and reinforces the need to consider the menstrual cycle in elite sports to reduce injury risk and to support the well-being of athletes.
Katie Gornall. One of the world's rarest storks is being protected by a group of women living in the remote Indian state of Assam, and their work has just won a Whitley Award, described as the Green Oscars. The stork is called the Greater Adjutant and known locally as the scavenger bird, or hargila, meaning bone swallower in Assamese. The women are led by Purnima Devi Barman, a wildlife biologist and conservationist. Here's Sir David Attenborough describing her success in saving the stork in a film for the Whitley Awards.
Her persistent campaigning quickly attracted support, particularly amongst the women of Assam. Purnima mobilised her followers into the Hargila Army, an all-female team dedicated to protecting the Greater Adjutant. Together, Purnima and her army are on a mission to break down barriers and challenge preconceptions.
And Purnima spoke to Martha Carney about the Hargila.
Everything is unreal for me. Sir David Attenborough, when talks like Purnima and Hargila army, I think it's a huge empowerment. I come from a village from Assam, and I think for all the women from our village, it's a huge recognition, and all the future generation, all the young girls, I am in tears. All the young girls from our Assam, and I think from India, it's a huge empowerment. I think many women will come forward, and thanks a lot.
Oh, well, it's wonderful to hear that. And just tell us why this bird, this scavenger bird, is so important to you. I mean, they're huge, aren't they? 5 foot tall, 8 foot wingspan.
Yeah, Hargila is, I think, one of the most beautiful birds in the world. And they look about my size, like a human being. And they're so magnificent with the wingspan, with a huge wingspan. I think they are the power to soar above challenges, and they give us the lessons of wisdom. And they are our cleaner birds. They are scavengers, and they are our cleaner birds. They make our landscape disease free. And
but that's not what local people think. That their reputation is that they're really dirty birds, aren't they?
Because they are scavenger birds, they go to garbage dump. Because of that, it was a very big reputation for the storks. People treated them often as a bad omen or a disease carrier or a pest.
But you're really changing their image, and you're fully on message today because you've got a beautiful sari which has been woven with images of the stork.
Yeah, so everything is changed now, and I'm very thankful to Whitley Awards for all this honour. And yeah, so as you ask, you can see our Hargila motif into our Assamese textiles. This is our Assamese dress, and we have many other textiles where our women weave the Hargila. They are very proud to celebrate the beauty of the bird, and this way it gives them economic opportunities, and it creates many opportunities for livelihoods for many households in Assam.
And finally, why did you decide to work with women rather than men?
when I started my work, all the time I often got complaint from people and from many men also that Hargila is a bad omen, a disease carrier. And it became a challenge for me to bring the birds into tradition and culture. And at that point, I always realized that our women have that power to bring Hargila into our Assamese culture, into our tradition.
Dr. Purnima Devi Barman. Now, they are a key part of any action movie, and yet they are usually overlooked. The stunt men and women who make sure that the stars look heroic but stay safe. Now, two of Hollywood's biggest names, Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, are starring in one of this year's blockbusters, The Fall Guy, based on the 1980s TV series of the same name. And they've been speaking to our culture reporter, Charlotte Gallagher, about this film, the Oscars, and recognition for stunt men and women.
Emily Blunt is the film director. And Ryan Gosling, the stuntman. The star of the film within the film has fallen in with a bad crowd.
You need to bring him back.
Why me?
You're a stuntman. Nobody's going to notice you. That's your job. No offence.
I mean, some taking.
How much did you have to do stunt-wise, Ryan? Like, what's the scariest thing that you had to do in this film?
I mean, they dropped me off of a building 12 stories at the beginning of the film, which took no skill at all on my end. I just got dropped. But that
it
was kind of scary.
Of guts.
It's a mental hurdle because I don't love heights.
I'm the director.
We're going to set this man on fire.
You're a stunt guy. We need to keep it super profesh.
Profesh is my middle name.
You said your middle name was Danger.
There's never been an Oscar to recognise the work of stuntmen and women, but both actors want to change that.
They dress like us. They do the dangerous things for us. They take the hits. They put themselves in harm's way for us. They play our characters as well. I mean, we're not the only ones that play our characters. They're actors too, same union, and yet they hide their face and disappear into the shadows, and everyone sort of pretends like they weren't there. The better they are at their job, the more they disappear in a way, and it's just... It ends now. It ends with this film. We're flipping the script.
Oscars for stuntman?
Yes, immediately now. Why not before?
Pretty crazy. Mm. They risk more than anyone. Their work is an art form. It's designed just as much as makeup or costumes or anything else. So when you understand what they're risking personally and physically, it only deepens your appreciation for what they do and what they contribute.
They've trained for this. Like, they have courage beyond words, and I think because there's such an innate humility with stunt performers that they don't feel the need to sort of broadcast what they do, but I think it's time that we do.
God, I hate that thumbs up stunt guy stuff.
I was particularly satisfied by your fight scenes, Emily.
Oh my
Thank
God.
Thank you very much.
She can turn anything into a deadly weapon.
Anything.
They don't call her Stunty Blunty for no reason.
Yeah. Stunty Blunty.
That is sort of the word on the street now.
And who's tougher, though, do you think, out of both of you? Because you both did stunts in this. Who do you think's the toughest one?
Equal Tufton.
This one's Tufton?
Equal Tufton, I think, I would say.
Yeah, but you're like...
I wouldn't have done that fall you did in the beginning.
No, but you're just tough. You squeezed in a half hour yesterday for
Pilates.
When the rest of us were...
taking a nap.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
You were planking.
Anyone but him. I didn't approve him. You know that. You are literally the last person on Earth I want to see.
I feel like you've got quite a British sense of humour. Is that
completely?
You get sarcasm,
Anglophilian sense of humour.
Can't tell if you guys are making fun of me or not.
No, you really do.
I'm kidding.
Really
see, I got the sarcasm.
Our culture reporter Charlotte Gallagher, who does her own stunts. And that's it from us for now. There will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this one or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. The producer was Vanessa Heaney. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
Up there, you have to be quick to make decisions because it's not a natural environment for survival.
Five incredible women.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
I risked my life many times
to be the first to climb all 8,000-meter peaks.
I had to finish it, accomplish it.
Search for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Up there, you have to be quick to make decisions because it's not a natural environment for survival.
Five incredible women.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
I risked my life many times
to be the first to climb all 8,000-meter peaks.
I had to finish it, accomplish it.
Search for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.